Let's go with your Bibles this morning, book of Proverbs chapter 1, book of Proverbs chapter 1, and we're going to read from there and use what we find there in our time together this morning. Proverbs chapter 1, good to see you this morning, appreciate the opportunity to worship with you. Proverbs chapter 1, the book of Proverbs opens this way. It says, to know wisdom and instruction, to understand words of insight, to receive instruction in wise dealing and righteousness, justice, and equity, to give prudence to the simple, knowledge and discretion to the youth. Let the wise hear and increase in learning, and the one who understands obtain guidance. To understand a proverb and a saying, the words of the wise and their riddles. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, and fools despise wisdom and instruction. There are a lot of places you could turn in the Bible this morning, but if you want one-stop shopping, one place to go to understand why things are the way they are, this is a pretty good place to turn to. And we live in a world that for so long, a culture that for so long has denigrated wisdom. We have pursued knowledge, not wisdom. And therefore, we don't know what to do with ourselves anymore. We know so much about the human body in our culture. We do wondrous things down in the medical center, largest medical complex in the world. We know so much about the human body, and yet we know so little about human nature in our world, about who and what we are, what we're capable of at our best and our worst. We do not understand anymore. I want, in the time that we have together this morning, just a very few minutes, I want in that time together to just consider a few simple ideas from a couple of places in the book of Proverbs, one of those places being the very way the book introduces itself to us. These verses, opening verses, are just loaded with ideas that could be chased in all sorts of different directions. He starts by just simply naming wisdom and instruction. Literally, that word instruction could also just as well be rendered as something more like discipline. Wisdom and discipline, the work of submitting ourselves under something that is bigger and different than ourselves. One of the tricks that happens in our culture is we kind of see wisdom as something that is subjective. Some people are wise, some people are not. Whereas in the Bible, while that may be sociologically true, there are some people who get it and some people who don't. Wisdom is a thing. Wisdom is objective. There is a substance to wisdom. It's not just every person's opinion and every person's kind of personal insight into something. There is an objective reality to world, and there is an objective reality to human nature, who and what we are. Again, in our culture, we've gotten to the point where the only thing that we think is really real and objective is that which you can quantify. If you can't boil it down to a statistic or a poll number, then it's just opinion. And in the Bible, that's just not true. There is an intangible, unseen, unquantifiable aspect to reality. There is the human soul. You'll never put that in a test tube. But it very much affects who we are and why we do what we do and why we feel the way we feel and why we think the way we think. And so therefore, we begin to understand that just because something is unseen or intangible or unquantifiable, it doesn't mean it's less real and it doesn't mean it's less subject to an objective wisdom bounded and founded in the fear of God. To understand wisdom and instruction, discipline, to put ourselves under wisdom and let wisdom shape us. It's not just a few maybe older people with life experience have their opinion about things. There is a wisdom that we can have. To receive, he goes on, after he basically opens by saying you need to learn how to live rightly and well. He goes on in verse 3 to say that the wise person, and I want you to notice how many of these coming verbs are passive or what you receive. Part of what's the nature of wisdom in the Bible is it's something that, yes, comes with age and experience, but the reason it comes with age and experience is because the older person has spent longer receiving an understanding and a truth about objective reality, learning what reality is, knowing it well, and then knowing how to react and live in light of it. The wise person receives teaching and formation, to receive instruction and wise dealing. And that boils down to three categories. He mentions there: righteousness and justice and equity. Part of the problem in our culture is nobody agrees on what's right anymore. And when you don't know what's right anymore, it's hard for anybody to agree on what's just anymore. And when you don't know what's just anymore, it's hard to have a world and a time and a place in which there is equity. When you throw out objective reality that's grounded in the fear of God, literally all hell is going to break loose. A true lack of wisdom. And again, it's something that we receive. It's not something that we project on the world. It's not something where we get together in our universities or in our political focus groups and we write out what it is. It is our job to receive it, to learn it from the one who is greater than us. And so you receive instruction in wise dealing, which means that then you will understand what righteousness and justice and equity are and how to have them. And flowing out of that then, that gives prudence to the simple. An understanding how to rightly live and speak and be. Knowledge and discretion to the youth. Knowledge and discretion to the youth. To understand what's right and what's wrong and how to respond and how to accomplish and how to bring people together and to drive people apart. Let the wise hear and increase in learning. And the one who understands obtain guidance to understand the words of the wise. Part of what's happened in our culture, folks, is that for a long time we haven't taught wisdom. We've taught knowledge. And there is a world of difference, and losing the recognition of the difference between those two things is what has brought us to this point. See, the fact of the matter is, wisdom is not intelligence. There's a difference. Wisdom is not intelligence. Wisdom is not a product of IQ. Listen, I can't go to MIT and become a rocket scientist. Don't have the math skills. That's a function of IQ. Some people got that kind of intelligence. Some people don't. But in the Bible, everybody can be wise. Because wisdom is not founded in knowledge. See, in our knowledge, we think wise people are smart people, high IQ people. Not necessarily. Not necessarily. Wisdom has nothing to do with what you know from a textbook. Wisdom comes from what you know about God, who he is, what man truly is, and what the world truly is, as God has revealed these things to us. Anybody can be wise because anybody can know the truth about that. Wisdom is about an attitude of reverence and respect to God that leads to a right orientation to reality. If you do not start from the fear of the Lord, you will never figure out righteousness, justice, and equity. You will never have insight. You will never have understanding. But the truth of the matter is, wisdom, despite its ability to bring us into harmony with reality and thus into harmony with each other, the truth is we live in a time in which there is a real wisdom crisis. And we see that in our leaders. And we see that in our institutions. And we see that in our streets. In a world in which there is so much knowledge and not enough wisdom out there, we are truly in a dangerous place. Decades ago, a wise English writer, T.S. Eliot, put it this way. He said, "All our knowledge brings us nearer to our ignorance." The more we know in this modern age, the more it drives us away from the truth about reality. That's the irony. The more we know about material reality, the more we have forgotten about spiritual reality. All our knowledge brings us nearer to our ignorance. And so he goes on to ask in his writing, where is the wisdom we have lost in knowledge? And Eliot was writing in an era, well, actually just before an era, in which we came up with this thing called a nuclear bomb. And that was, for those of you who go back in the history and culture of Western civilization a little bit, that was a real wake-up call for a lot of people. When the atomic bombs were dropped on Hiroshima, Nagasaki, people began to realize, and there was a real crisis when you go back and look at the newspaper articles and the magazine articles of that era, people began to realize that our knowledge has outpaced our human ethics and capacity for good judgment. We now have the knowledge of how to obliterate life on this planted in an instant, but our human capacity for love and compassion and insight and judgment has not kept up with our knowledge of material reality. People begin to realize that we as a race were getting into a very dangerous place. And the same thing happens with our communication technology now, even in the era that we are living in. We get images and information in real time from all over the world. We are constantly bombarded with the predicament of the human race. All the crises, all the tragedies, all the pains, all the wrongdoing from every corner of this nation and every corner of the planet beamed into our homes and 24/7 real time on cable TV, or constantly is our phone ding notifications of the latest outrage or tragedy or natural disaster? And we weren't meant to live this way, folks. We don't have the wisdom to live with omniscience. We lack full knowledge. We lack perspective. We weren't meant to carry the weight of the world's messes and failures and tragedies and pain and suffering. And so in one sense, it's no one that we have overstimulated ourselves with knowledge without the wisdom of how to handle all that we know about the mess of the human race. There was a movie probably 15 years ago now. It was meant to be a comedy, and it was a clever comedy, in which a man thought he could run the world better than God. And so God took him up on that offer and said, all right, you can be God for a while. And so he gave him divine powers without divine character. He got the power to be God without the knowledge and wisdom to be God. And so the movie was meant to be a comedy, an insightful comedy, a clever comedy, where it kind of draws you in. The man goes out and begins to do all the things that you and I would do in our worst moments if we had all power, get even with our enemies, and give everything that we wanted materially to ourselves, basically use the power for our own enjoyment and our own gratification and our own satisfaction. But eventually the man began to discover that gets kind of boring after a while. And so he began to kind of think about doing more good for others with the power. And he begins to do that for a while. And he keeps on growing into what it means to have God power, but he's still a human being. And he finally begins, because he begins to actually realize, I'll take this seriously and use this for others. He begins to accept the prayers of the world. And it's at that moment in the movie, that's the turning point of the movie. It's at that point in the movie when he tunes in. And it's a clever point in the movie. Rather than literally hearing the prayers, what he does is he logs into God's email account. And that's where all the prayers come into the world. So he begins to go through God's email, all the requests for the world. Help me, I have cancer. Help me, my child is sick. Help me, I've lost my job. Help me, my country is collapsing. Just all the struggles and pain and prayers of the world come to him. And it's in that moment he begins to realize, I can't do this. I can't bear this weight. I hear all this, but I don't know what to do about it, even if I have the power. I don't know what's just and what's fair and what's right in all situations. I'm just a man, not meant to bear the burden. The thing is, in our time, we become more and more godlike in our power, our technology, without the knowledge or wisdom to handle it. We become more and more godlike in our ability to be omniscient, to know what's going on. But we're not equipped to handle this, folks. We lack the wisdom to be God. We lack the wisdom to have the power and the knowledge that technology grants us. We're meant to live small. We're meant to live local. We're meant to live face to face. We're meant to bear and share the troubles and the cares and the trials and the tragedies of the people we know, not of the world that we can never know. We're not meant to be God. And so part of what wisdom teaches us, and the fact that we receive this and we learn this and it grants insight, but it's above all grounded in the fear of God, is that we accept a discipline that this is what the world is, that these are what human limitations are, that this is what we can do on the one hand and what God alone can do on the other. Proverbs chapter 3 and verse 19, that little section there begins and it says this. Listen, it says, the Lord by wisdom founded the earth. By understanding he established the heavens. By his knowledge the deeps broke open and the clouds dropped the dew. My son, do not lose sight of these. Keep sound wisdom and discretion and they will be life for your soul and adornment for your neck. You want to keep your head screwed on straight, my son? Remember that God runs the world and he alone is God. And the wise man does not think he's growing in such knowledge and understanding and insight he can replace God or be God. The more he grows in knowledge and understanding, he realizes how much he is not God. And therefore, how much he needs God. We lack the wisdom to be God. We can't change the way the world is. Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verse 14, the preacher there, another wise man, said this and put it this way. He said, I have seen everything that is done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and striving after the wind. What is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be counted. There's a sense in which we tell young people for too long, we've told them, you know, you can change the world. There's a sense in which you can make things better and you can make things different and you can surely let your voice be heard. But the idea that we're going to fundamentally change the brokenness of the world before Jesus comes back is a mistake. And so many people become so disappointed and depressed and frustrated when we do not accept that what is broken cannot be fixed by man. What is crooked cannot be made straight. The book of Proverbs, when you go back, and I encourage you, if you have not lately, and you need a reset, a reality check, something to comfort you and encourage you, you go back and you spend more time in the book of Proverbs. One of the things that Proverbs does, again, is it reconnects us with the reality, not of the world as we wish it was, but the world as it actually is. And one of the things that happens in the book of Proverbs and the wisdom that is the fear of the Lord that is found in it is that the book of Proverbs starts from the unspoken assumption that the world is broken in a way that only God can fix. There were always going to be, to use the book of Proverbs vocabulary, there were always going to be fools out there who cause much destruction. There are always going to be evil and wicked people out there who hurt the innocent. There's always going to be tragedy and misfortune out there from the natural world and the time and chance that happened to all. There is going to always be a broken world out there. And therefore, the wise person who fears God is going to follow God's will and God's perspective and God's limits and God's insight into how not just the world is, but the ways in which the world is broken, the truth about human nature. And in so doing, the wise person is not going to change the world. The wise person is going to learn how to navigate the minefield of a fallen world so that God can be glorified and the righteous person can maintain their integrity before God and before their fellow man. And that's part of what Proverbs brings us back to, the humility to know the things I can change, the things I can't change, and the wisdom to know the difference between the two. And so maybe to give one quick proverb, one place to maybe seek biblical wisdom in this difficult time that we are in, let me give you one proverb this morning for your own meditation. And that, by the way, this is the trick about Proverbs in general. You know, we kind of get trained in our desire for daily Bible reading. You know, you got to get through 5 chapters today, right? Man, plow through. Going to get through. The point is to get done, not to necessarily learn something, meditate on it, grow in it. That's not the best way to read the Bible in the first place. It's about quality, not quantity. It's about actually understanding and what you're reading and letting it deepen your faith in God, grow your character, sustain your faith, rather than just saying, I got through 5 chapters today. But the other thing is the book of Proverbs won't work that way at all. They're deceptively simple, but that's the whole point. You're supposed to stay and think a while on each one. You're supposed to stick a stake there for a while and think about it and think about it and think about it until it hurts. And it hurts because you're bored. It hurts because you finally realized how this one hits you between the eyes. And that's how you grow in wisdom and in insight and in prudence. That's how you become wise. And so here's a proverb that I think is particularly apt for our time and place. Proverbs 29 and verse 20. Do you see a man who is hasty in his words? There is more hope for a fool than for him. I think one of the greatest challenges of the moment that we have been in is so many of us have felt pressure to say something. I will tell you as a preacher, that has been a real pressure and a real temptation. Because after all, that's what preachers do. We make our living by saying words, too many of them sometimes, 40-minute sermons instead of 25, as though we're getting paid by the word or something. There is a pressure to speak before we have thought, before we have understood, before we have listened, before we know all the facts. Before we have interrogated our own position, our own presuppositions, before we have honestly wrestled with in our hearts, am I doing this for the right reasons or the wrong reasons? You've been on social media lately? One of the issues with social media is that there is nothing there to check me, to slow me down, to make me think and rethink and measure my words. problem with social media is people have arguments in real time now who aren't even together. They could be halfway across the country or across the planet. I made the mistake of logging into Facebook a couple times this week. And then one place I was watching an argument going in real time. You know how Facebook works where you can actually watch, you know, the comments and they're just, you know, they're popping up and it's almost like rabbits in Australia. I mean, they're just like reproducing like wildfire. And Facebook almost eggs you on because there's this thing that will happen to you. Those of you who've been on there, you know what I'm talking about. Somebody will say, someone is typing. And now what are you going to do? Well, now you just got to stay and see what they're going to say. And maybe that triggers you or provokes you. Now you've got to say something. You know, but it's like Facebook wants you to know this argument, this conversation, it's happening in real time. Stick around, see what's going to happen. You realize, by the way, folks, you realize social media exists, no matter what the rhetoric is, social media exists to make money. It's a business. They want you to stay there. They want you to do this. They want you to act this way. It makes more money for them. And so we get on social media, people have arguments in real time rather than thinking and checking themselves and slowing themselves and measuring their words. And so what happens? Listen, we've all done this, I think most of us. Someone's post inflames our emotions, and so we immediately start typing a response, not thinking about how the words will sound or affect others, not thinking about whether what we are saying or typing is good and true and beautiful. Not thinking about whether what we are saying, our information, our perspective, our facts, our judgment is correct or helpful. Not thinking about whether the world really needs another opinion out there right now to keep the argument going. Not thinking about whether our words are going to help or hurt the work of God on earth to spread his kingdom. Not thinking about whether we will answer and give an account to God someday for the words we are typing. Not thinking about whether what we are doing is in wisdom. You see a man hasty in his words? In fact, that'll almost be the tagline under Twitter or Google or Facebook. Come see people hasty in their words and watch the human train wreck that happens. I want you to think about what social media has done to conversation and discourse in our culture. And what I fear for is our younger generation who never remembers a world where there wasn't social media. Those of us who are, you know, and I don't want to put a number on it, but of a certain age and older can remember, not that the world was, you know, again, all puppy dogs and rainbows before, but it used to be before social media. It actually took a lot more effort to have an argument with people. You think about that? It used to be that you had to be face-to-face with someone to have a disagreement. And even then, there was something about being face-to-face in a disagreement or a quarrel, or even just a challenging conversation that was awkward and painful to have. There was something about being face-to-face and seeing the other person's body language that naturally checked any decent person from saying what was really on their mind, because I could see your face and I could watch your countenance fall, and I could actually see in real time the context of which my words hurt you. And then I'm immediately beginning to think, is this really worth saying? Does this really need to be said? Do we really need to keep this going? Emojis are not body language. It used to be that when you read something that inflamed your passions and got you all riled up, it was either in a newspaper or a letter. And you know what you had to do? This is shocking to young people. It was called the post office. And what you had to do, if you wanted to say something about it, you just had to set that person straight, that crazy newspaper columnist, that ignorant reporter, that person that was quoted in the story who just doesn't get it, some politician or leader or person. You just needed to let your two cents be in out there. It used to be that if you read something that inflamed your passions from a newspaper, or you got a letter from a friend or a family member and it said something that upset you, what you had to do was you had to go and you had to sit down, and you had to get a piece of paper, and you had to get a pen, and you had to write it all out by hand, which took a lot longer than typing it, folks. It took a lot longer, and there was a physical activity. And physical activity literally is a way of dissipating the chemicals and the biology of emotion. And so you had to sit down with a piece of paper and write it all out by hand, which naturally slows you down and calms you down. And when you were through with that step, which may take a good hour because, you know, I can type in 3 minutes. It takes me an hour to write by hand. Then what I had to do is I had to actually go and find an envelope. Oh, there are no envelopes. So now I have to go to the store and get an envelope. And at this point, you begin to say, is it worth it? Well, it's worth it. So I go to the store and I get an envelope. But then I get home and I don't have stamps. Oh, I have a stamp. And so I'm rummaging through the kitchen drawer like we've all done to try to find that one last stamp in the house. And after 15, 20, 30 minutes of trying to find the stamp, I find it and I've got it. I've got my envelope, I got my stamp, and I got my letter. 3 or 4 hours into this process now to make sure the editor knows what an idiot he is. Though you begin to wonder, who's the idiot here? And then what you had to do, once you put your letter in the envelope, sealed it up, put the stamp on it, you had to go to bed because the mail's already come by this point. And you had to go to bed, and you had to sleep 8 hours and calm down. And you get up in the morning, and then you have to walk out to the mailbox and put it in the mail. And by that point, you'd calmed down, you'd had a chance to think about what you were saying and why you were saying it and how you were saying it. And then you might very well go and tear up the letter because it simply wasn't worth saying it anymore. You see, a man who's hasty in his words, there's more hope for a fool than for him. Whoever is slow to anger, the wise man says in Proverbs 16 and verse 32, whoever is slow to anger is better than the mighty, and he who rules his spirit than he who conquers a city. Real strength, according to the wisdom that is founded in the fear of God, is the ability to control your spirit. That's the Bible's word for what we call there our emotions. In difficult situations, especially when everyone else is losing control of theirs. Proverbs goes on and puts it this way in Proverbs 25 and verse 8. A man without self-control is like a city broken into and left without walls. Self-control is what saves us and keeps us whole and wise and walking in integrity. When I speak words that are coming primarily from emotion and pain, I need to be careful. By the same token, when I am writing words to somebody in pain, and I'm writing from a place of comfort and complacency, I need to be careful. I want you to think about the word insensitive for a moment. The word insensitive. That's a good word to describe sometimes those who respond from a place with no real understanding, from a place of comfort and complacency, and they respond to people who are in pain and hurting. Rather than with empathy, they want to set them straight in a way that is unempathetic or unknowing. And we sometimes use the word for the people like that who write from comfort or complacency. We call them insensitive. Think about that word insensitive for a moment. What does it mean? Insensitive, unsensing, doesn't get it, doesn't see, speaks or writes or acts from a place where they do not fully understand the situation. You do not understand the other viewpoint. You do not understand where the other person's coming from. They are insensitive. They are missing something and how they respond. Do you see that? That sometimes we write from a place of emotion rather than reflection. And sometimes we write from a place of complacency and show our insensitivity. And in this day and age, I think both are a problem. Do you see a man who's hasty in his words? Who doesn't stop to say, am I writing this from a bad place? Have I forgotten what the book of James says, that the anger of man will never accomplish the righteousness of God? Or am I writing from a place of indifference and lack of concern and understanding? Am I telling somebody to get over it before I even know what I'm telling them to get over? I am insensitive. I have not rightly sensed, perceived, understood. I do not have insight, wisdom's words, into what I am speaking about. People use hasty words coming from both places, and it's a challenge. And social media is where you can spend all day, every day watching this entire dynamic unfold in real time. Someone is typing. Worldliness comes in many forms, brethren. Not just sexual immorality, not just drunkenness. Sometimes it comes by letting the world guide us and what to think, what to feel, and how to act. Losing our heads with the rest of the world rather than showing them that God has given us a wisdom and how to react in times. May God help us in these difficult times. Show the world the light of his kingdom and his people, not just in the love we have for each other, but even in the wisdom and how we respond and what we do and what we say, that the world can truly look at us and say God is among them. The world, so many people who are hurting and looking for answers, perspective, stability, looking for love and understanding. And they find it here because this is the people who practice the love of Jesus and the wisdom that comes from the fear of God. God, help us to be those kind of people in this kind of time. We're going to sing a song, and as we sing this song, this is a great opportunity for somebody who needs to take advantage of this moment to get their life right with God to do that. If that means for you, depending on where you're at, it means obedience to the gospel of Jesus Christ. It means a confession that you believe Jesus Christ is the Son of God, and as you repent of your place and participation in the world, we'll baptize you for forgiveness of your sins, and you can become one of God's people and walk this wilderness road to the heavenly city. We'd love for you to join us on that journey. If you're here this morning, you're a child of God, but you recognize that the times have gotten to you in some way. Some worldly temptation or desire has warped your soul, and it's come out maybe in what you've said or what you've done, how you've affected some people, and you need to get that right. And maybe you just need the love and the strength of brethren knowing your burden and praying for you and knowing and being sensitive in a world of insensitivity, because wisdom requires that we know what's going on so that we can help. We'd love to hear from you too. Why don't you talk to us while we stand, while we sing.